I want to continue and, well, finish, unfortunately, what we're going to say about NVs. So let's remind ourselves of where we are. We have a vacancy, we have a nitrogen, it's embedded in a diamond. So this is our NV center. And then somewhere sitting out here, there's also some carbon-13 in the system. Remember, it's 1%, but of course, you don't have to go very far out to find the first one. And if it is the first one, then the hyperfine interaction is quite strong. There would be a hyperfine interaction here of 150 megahertz. And we saw that there was a zero field splitting. And this is due to the exchange interaction. And it's about 3 gigahertz. For the nitrogen, there's a Zeeman interaction. And there's a quadrupole interaction. And the quadrupole interaction is just a coupling of the electric field gradient surrounding the nitrogen with the asymmetry charge distribution in the nitrogen's nucleus. And fortunately, because everything's tied to the same defect, these two share a principal axis system. No. These two share a principal axis system. The Zeeman interaction, and of course there's a Zeeman interaction here as well, they share a principal axis system with the external magnetic field. And what we normally try to do is to align the external magnetic field with that axis. And so you would scan through, find your diamond, go ahead, and as we showed on the board yesterday, look at the spectra just under microwave irradiation and see that we have an NV in that it has the properties we want. Usually what that means is that you have an NV, it doesn't have the properties you want, and you find the next one, and that after a few days of searching, you have the one that you want. And then you arrange that your microscope sits on that one. And hopefully, if nothing goes bad, you can sit on that NV for months and months and have the same system. But then, having found that, we align the external magnetic field with this principal axis system. And we do that to have a simplified dynamics, and of course to have a small set of good quantum numbers. Now, if I chose that the field was not along the principal axis system, then of course this field would introduce a mixing between those energy levels. And so I would see that in the spectra. Now, the hyperfine interaction, of course, here has asymmetry to it. So this, once I've aligned the Zeeman interactions, I've aligned the quadrupole and the zero field nature did for me, but this piece is always going to have an asymmetric part to it. Okay, it's just the way it goes. Good. And so the hyperfine piece we'll have two terms. The piece that we're mostly interested in is this parallel component, but the perpendicular component is important as well. Good. And we drew up the energy levels for this. Where we have the electron Zeeman, the zero field splitting, and then for the nitrogen, we have three states. And for the nitrogen, the hyperfine line, of course, is not going to be split. The nitrogen Zeeman term will shift those. But remember that this splitting is 3 gigahertz, and that splitting of the nitrogen Zeeman is about 10 kilohertz. And so, yes, it's there, but it's very hard to see. The hyperfine interaction, however, is big. The hyperfine interaction is 2.5 megahertz. And so this piece we'll see. And we'll have these allowed transitions. Okay. All right, so we've got our system here of eigenstates. Now, we talked at the very end about control. And we said that, look, controlling the nitrogen spin or any hyperfine coupled spin, you know, it's a little bit nicer to talk about the carbon, is a drag if we need to control it directly, because it takes a long time to apply a microwave field and rotate that. And instead, what I want to do is I want to use the electron spin as an actuator so that all the control comes from the electron. We just rotate the electron in some complicated fashion. And what I hope I had convinced you of is that we have control. So if I look at the Hamiltonian of this, and now I'm writing this down for spin 1/2 particles, just because the next step in this will be a mess if I write it down for spin 1 particles. We get this nice term, and you know, there's two pieces that give us the universality. One, that the nuclear spin is quantized first in the hyperfine interaction, and that the nuclear Zeeman interaction competes with that. I mean, if I didn't have this, and then I changed the state of the electron spin, right, it would just be a global negative sign, and so nothing interesting would happen. And so in order to have control, the Zeeman interaction needs to compete with the hyperfine interaction, and the hyperfine interaction needs to be to not commute with the Zeeman interaction, and we have all that here. Okay, so therefore we can have control. Good. And it's worthwhile, because I'm going to have to draw a different picture in a second, just to draw out the energy level diagrams for this. So if I look at starting where I have the electron Zeeman, then I define the electron spin. And then these get split by the nuclear zamon. And of course, the nuclear zamon term is very small compared to the electron spin. The ordering of these turns out to be this, which is just a reflection of the sign of those two interactions, but nothing interesting. So this is just adding this term, of course. Then we add the ZZ term, and so we get a shifts of these things. But having shifted the energy levels, nothing happened except that we have additional splitting. Not additional splitting, we have a change in the splitting. And then, but this term now mixes these. So what happens now is that at this point, let's look at this just to at this point, if I apply just microwave control, so the operator that I'm applying to the system would be sigma x on the electron spin, right? Then the transitions that are allowed is this transition and this transition, right? From the microwave spin flip, that's all that we're allowed. We have to conserve the nuclear spin flip. But when I add this anisotropic term, then I get a mixing of the eigenstates. They do shift in energy, but let's not worry about that. And because now I have this mixture of eigenstates, I can't describe them in terms of the MZ quantum number for the nuclear spin, right? I have to describe them in some other state, which I've just called beta. And then, so beta and beta perp, of course. So those are orthogonal. But the important part is that those are not. And now then, every transition is allowed. So if I apply a sigma x operator, every transition of an electron spin. So this state can go there, and it can go there. And of course, this state can go here and there. Another way of thinking about this universality condition in this, okay? And if you haven't seen such mixing of energy levels, it's a reasonable thing to go back to a Hamiltonian. I probably should have asked you to do this. It as if you take this Hamiltonian, then this term commutes with this term. But this term doesn't commute with this term. And so now then, I can say, well, why do I have these three terms? This term is the biggest, and it sets the quantization axis. So that says that in the absence of everything else, I'm going to take the eigenstates of the sum of sigma z. And you know, we know what those are. Life is good. This term is mixing, so the C for coupling. This term mixes these eigenstates. And because it doesn't commute with this, then if this term is big compared to that, we'll have a mixture. If it's small, we won't. And so the diagram you want to plot is to say, okay, let's hold one of those constant, and let's involve just vary delta omega, because it has a nice simple picture. And we'll call that zero. And I know that when delta omega is big, I'm going to have four eigenstates. And the eigenstates are going to be up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. And then as I change delta omega, these things are always going to be good eigenstates, right? Because we're only mixing those middle two. And of course, when omega is big, they're still going to be good eigenstates. But in between, we get a mixture. And of course, what you would like to see is you get an anticrossing, and that this point here, at that point, you have the anticrossing that would give you the triplet structure. So I take it from your looks that this isn't a problem that was set for you during your quantum mechanics courses. You know, take 5 minutes with Mathematica and have a look. And you know, it's a nice thing to get some insight into how this works. Yeah. Okay. Now this piece said, fine, I can have an electron spin, and I can use it to control however many nuclear spins I have. And I haven't shown you, but it is really quite a simple step to show that if you have a bunch of nuclear spins, they're coupled to a central electron spin. And if each of the nuclear spins has an anisotropic hyperfine interaction, meaning this term exists for each of them, and if the frequencies of the nuclear spins, the hyperfine interactions, are different, so you can't have accidental degeneracies. If you have those two cases, then via control of the electron spin alone, you have universality over that entire Hilbert space. Okay? But what's a more interesting problem is, let's take two centers. And look at the control over these two. So I'll take these electrons and assume that the electrons are two NV systems. And at the moment, let's just put them some distance apart, but there's still a dipole-dipole interaction between the electron spins. And you know, the dipole-dipole interaction we wrote out last class is still just this classical dipole energy, suitably quantized because we're looking at a spin. So it's going to look like sigma dot sigma minus 3 sigma z, OK? And of course, it falls off as 1 over r cubed. But the electron magnetic moment is big. In fact, remember that the electron magnetic moment is about a factor of 1,000 bigger than the nuclear spin. And so if I was comparing the coupling of two electrons to the coupling of two nuclei that are next to those electrons, the nuclear-nuclear coupling is a factor of 1,000,000 times smaller, right? And so we can easily say, look, these two don't see each other directly, OK? But they do have a hyperfine interaction. And we know that the nuclear spin holds quantum information much longer, much more effectively than the electron spin. But the electron spin is a system that we can read out. We can't read out the nuclear spin directly. And the electron spin, we can polarize, and we can rotate it quickly. So then if I said I want to use this as my processor, and this is the actuator, then I want to find a way of connecting those two. And you may have heard from Ray that a swap gate is universal. No? Yes? I tell you, a swap gate is universal. So what I want to do is I want to be able to swap those two. If we can show that we can do a swap, then we've done everything we want. Now,
you mean swap plus one single qubit?
You know, it depends upon how you want to code. If you have only swaps and you're willing to give up a qubit for your code, then you have universal control anyway. There's lovely work by Robert Chertoff and Brigitte Whaley, David DiVincenzo about 15 years ago. And if I want each qubit, each spin to be a qubit, then as you say, I should be able to rotate one as well. Yeah? And you know, that goes back to our conversation on Wednesday that, you know, universality is easy to come by. Okay. So now then we look here and we see that we could make this swap gate by swapping here, and then swapping here, and then swapping here, and then swapping here, and then swapping there, right? Or if, you know, you could be a little bit more clever. You can say, well, I'm going to swap here, and then I'm going to swap here, and then I'm going to swap there, right? And that gives you the control. But come on. We're physicists. We can do better than that. And so if you take that insight and say, well, what I need to do is I need to connect the hyperfine and dipolar interactions. Then if you look at the second commutator of the dipolar term with the hyperfine, and you write it out, and it's a mess. And then you take that mess, and with a little bit of knowing what you want, you rewrite it. You can rewrite it in this lovely form. Yeah. So it says that what you're allowed to do is you're allowed to flip the electron spin, provided you flip the nuclear spins. And I want to show you just how nice that is. So what we're going to do is we're going to write down the energy level diagram for this system. I'm going to write it down in a simple way. So this is the nuclear spin. So everything that I do, these little blocks, is going to be nuclear spins. But this is living in the ground state of the electron spin. So that's electron A, electron B, and this is nucleus A, nucleus B. And of course, if I want to do control, going back to our conversation of yesterday at the end, we would like to, if we're going to use an electron spin as control, I want to live in the ground state of the electron spin. I always want to return there, okay? That's because if I'm using the electron spin as an actuator, at the end of the day, I don't want any information hanging out in the electron spin, okay? So we're always going to return here. And now what we want to do is I want this interaction, right? That's what a swap gate on the nuclear spins would connect. And of course, I have no Hamiltonian that connects those. Okay, so, you know, you're out of luck. But we go and we look at the first excitation manifold. So it's the first excitation manifold of the electron spin. And again, we'll keep the nuclear spin labeling exactly the same. Now we go back over here and we say, well, I've got this term. Now, of course, look, this term is a second order term. And I don't know how many times you've had to go to second order in any of your calculations. But usually we say, oh, you know, second order, we're not going to worry about. It's a second order term. But let's look at what it connects. It says, I should flip the electron spin. So I should go from this manifold to that manifold. But in doing so, I need to flip the nuclear spins. So we're going to connect this state, and we're going to connect those two. And that's what our second order commutator is going to do for us. And now then, you can see what we're going to do, I hope. We're going to take, and I want to get this system into this first excitation manifold, so I can drive it over that process. And so now if I'm exciting the electron spin, those are the allowed transitions. And they have this really nice feature. It says, oh, I'm going to take this state, I'm going to drive it up here, and this second order commutator is going to take me over here and then return me to this place. Okay? And vice versa for the other path. Now, some physics I'm not going to show you, but it's in our paper. You can read it. If I take all of these Rabi-free drives, and I set them equal. And that's not something you get by accident. You have to do that, right? But you go, you do that. Then what happens is that this term becomes the leading term. In the interaction frame where those four electron transitions are being driven in phase with each other, then that double flip-flop term is the leading term. And it shows up with a strength that's given by effectively the dipolar frequency. The other thing that happens is as you're driving this, the Rabi frequency is the strongest thing in the system, right? That's why I'm going into the interaction of the Rabi drive. As I go into the interaction of the Rabi drive, what's going on is that this coherence is being driven back and forth many times. So the information here is coming up, it's going down, it's coming up, it's going down. But as it does that, it's coherently moving over to this piece. Okay? So the information is never living very long in the excitation manifold. And so we can ask, well, we know that the electron spin is the least coherent thing in the system. So I have some electron T2. And you might worry that I'm going to lose information via the electron T2. But provided that the electron T2 times the Rabi is greater than 1, then when you go and you write out the Krauss operators, you can see that you're never going to lose any information on the system. It's as though you're doing a lot of spin echoes by going up and down, up and down, up and down a lot. And experimentally, this number is 10 to the 5. And so we're bigger than 1. The other final nice piece is if I had many nuclear spins, let's come back over here. If I had another nuclear spin, another nuclear spin, then I could simultaneously have swaps between these, and you can have much more complicated gates. And so even though we're using these electron spins as actuators, right? What they're doing is they're mediating these other paths. And so we don't have to think that, well, I only have 2 electron spins, I only have 1 quantum channel. In fact, what I have is I open up a quantum channel between all the nuclear spins. And so I have a really wide quantum channel, which is what we call the paper. Okay. So that gets us coupling in general. Now you could do the same thing with the cavity. And if I had more time, I'd show you that I could replace the electron spin with the cavity. And if I could, a microwave circuit with a high Q. And if I could restrict myself to being in the first excitation manifold, then I could do the same physics. It's, of course, much easier to restrict yourself to being the first excitation manifold if you have 2-level systems. Okay. Now I want to look at going back to the NV.
Question.
Yeah.
This 4 nitrogen, 4 nuclei you've drawn, right? So this operation does the swap simultaneously. What if I only want to swap A and B and not C and D?
Yeah, you can do that too.
Do so, I have to sort of detune the Rabi so that?
That's right. C and D. Yeah. All of your control is in your choice of the effective Rabi frequencies. And, you know, here we make it look like I'm just applying a continuous microwave pulse. What we're really doing is you apply a modulated microwave pulse. And in an effective Hamiltonian picture, you're connecting those. So, you know, if you were just applying a continuous wave microwave pulse, you may not be able to find that solution. But since all you need is the effective Hamiltonians to be right, then there's always a solution. Okay. So now then, I want to take an NV with one C13, and we're going to forget about the nitrogen. The nitrogen has a really long lifetime. So let's just only do an experiment if the nitrogen's in its zero state, which is the nicest place for it to be. Okay? And what I want to do is think about this as using the NV as a sensor, but augmented by having a small quantum processor, and to see what we can do. So the first thing we do is we polarize the NV, which is easy. We turn on the laser, and we have a state which is zero for the NV, tensor identity for the carbon. So horrible nomenclature, but if I only looked at the NV, it's pure. And then I swap. And then I polarize the NV again, and now I have a state that I'm happy with. Okay? And I want to make a measurement. So we take this piece, and I say, use the NV to measure. Now, of course, I don't want to use the carbon to measure, because the carbon has such a wimpy magnetic moment. You know, it's going to be too slow to do anything interesting with. But the NV has this whopping big one, so we're in good shape. So we use this to measure, and we end up with some state that looks like that. And of course, alpha squared and beta plus beta squared is 1, all the good stuff. Okay? Now, here, if I just measured this, I wouldn't be using the carbon spin. So what I'll do is I'll take this and apply a controlled NOT gate. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to conditionally flip the state of the carbon based upon the state of the electron. So we create a state which is potentially entangled depending on our choice of alpha and beta. And now here, I make a measurement. And now we need to be careful. So I make a measurement, and what do I find? You say, with probability alpha squared, I find that the electron's in zero, right? Okay, good. And with probability beta squared, and if the electron is zero, then the carbon is up, otherwise it's down. What is the state of the electron? Well, we turned on the bloody laser to measure, right? And every time we turn on the laser, the state of the electron is the ground state. So we found out, we learned, whether the electron was up or was in zero or one. But we returned a state with the electron in the zero state. Yeah? Now the other thing to remember here is that it looks like, you know, it's tempting at this moment to say, oh, this is a separable state. I still have coherence. But you don't have any bloody coherence here, right? You went through this excited manifold, the frequencies are different, you crashed down in some random time, you decohered, you got that, or you have that, and there's your probabilities, yeah? So we go and we take these states, and I apply a controlled knot. If I apply a controlled knot to rotate the electron spin conditioned on the carbon spin. Okay, so now then we end up, we have this probability alpha squared, and we end up in the state 0, 1. We had this probability beta squared, we end up in the state 1 down. And I make a measurement. And what do I get? Well, yeah, same thing. If I was in this state, then with probability 1, right, I get the state 1, 0. And if I was in this state, then with probability 1, I get the state 1 down. And now then, of course, I can apply these controlled knot gates again. And I can repeat that measurement. Now, why is this useful? It's useful because I never had to condition anything I was doing on my state of knowledge. And so I could keep interrogating the system. And I can build up the statistics for sampling. But it's a really weird sort of sampling, right? Because I'm sampling one arm or the other arm. So if I wanted to have an expectation value, I can't just sit here. I need to go back here, right? But I certainly do get more photons by doing this. And experimentally, we can go through these cycles 100 times and, you know, remember that we said that the probability of getting a photon at any individual emission is about 1%. We get 10 emissions or 20 emissions during a window. So if I really want to get some photons, being able to cycle through this 100 times makes a big difference. Yeah? But now one asks, well, how would you really want to use this if you want to more efficiently measure alpha and beta? And more interestingly, how would I use this method if I could control the state, if there's some noise that's affecting the system, and I want to pick my signal out of the noise, or if I was looking at a two-state system and I had some switch to move between them? And so that's what your homework refers to. So let me try one more board. There's two ways we normally think about using entanglement. Let me say one more thing here. If I have a spin, and I have some processor. I want to write it, the processor on one side. It may be useful that the only interaction I have with my unknown system is through that one spin. And it may be useful that the only interaction I have is at an instant in time that I choose. It's not continuous. And that's what we do here. We say, oh, well, I have this processor, okay, the processor at this point is only one other spin. But although I repeatedly interrogate the processor, there was only one moment at the beginning where I actually allowed the system to interact with the piece that I'm measuring. And of course, from the point of view of the rest of the processor, the rest of the processor never sees that interaction, right? It all comes through this piece here. Now, the way that we've normally thought about this is to say, well, let's take this spin. So I have my unknown that I want to measure. And then I have my good spin here that we're going to measure with. And then I have the processor spins. And you could see that if I took all of these spins and I put them in the zero state, and if I took this and applied a Hadamard, and then a series of control knots, then I could create here a huge GHZ state. So I could, if I have n spins here, I can create the state 0, 0, 0, n times plus 1, 1, 1, n times. And given that huge state, I could interact once with the piece that I want to learn about. Apply the inverse of that. And then at the end of this, this state here would be either, if question mark was zero, or fully polarized if the question mark was one. And then I would measure not this one spin, but I'd measure the whole thing. And I would get a whopping big signal, yes or no. And I could tell you the fiducial state of that spin, right? We're making a classical measurement. We're using a quantum device to make a measurement of a classical piece. Yeah? That's not what we're doing up here. Okay? And of course, the nice thing about this is also to say this stuff, you know, it doesn't even need to be local, right? The only thing that needs to be local to this one is that one spin. Everything else, take it where you want. Do what you want with it. Now the other, so that's one, that's amplification. Now I can call it amplification because I'm measuring a classical quantity with a quantum processor. Now, the other way of doing it is to say, oh, I want to have a robustness. So you imagine that I have some field that's noise and some field that's interesting. And by hook or crook, you can make this thing oscillate with a nice frequency. Then we can take our spin that's coupled to this, and we can apply a series of pi pulses. And remember, if I sandwich a field by pi pulses, it looks like I inverted it. So whereas if I was to just look at the interaction of this oscillating field with the spin, it would average to zero. But if I know the frequency and am clever about where I put the pi pulses, then it will have a big influence. And of course, if this field doesn't share the same frequency, then I suppress the effect of that field. Okay? All right. Now, what can we do in the NV case? And if the NV has a long, if the nuclear spin of the NV has a long lifetime, T1, okay, then I can do an experiment that's like this. Only I can control how I correlate the states at different times. Okay? And you should look at that and figure out the details. What would be nice is to say, oh, can I use it in a scheme akin to this? to get more information out of the system, and even could I use a processor to get out an angle? And, well, let me not give you the answers. You'll give me the answers, okay? And of course, we don't know everything we can do with those NV processors, but we do know a few things, and so you can go ahead and have a look. Yeah? This is, okay, let's stop there.